Welcome to Holden Village's Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Educational Network and Support. This evening we'll be listening to a fireside chat with Dr. Lull. Let's listen in.
Wide open, it's time for people to ask questions of Dr. Lull, so who wants to start?
I'd like to start asking about the socks.
These socks?
Yeah.
They bother you.
No, they're nice. I like
aren't they good? Yeah, I think Kmart.
Kmart?
Yeah. $2 for $6?
Okay.
No, actually, these came from, that's not true. You get socks like this at Kmart. These came from regular sporting goods store or something like that.
That's got glad to know that you didn't do the big box shopping.
Yeah. I was in Kmart as recently as Saturday, so. I don't want you to think just because I live in Berkeley that I'm out of touch with American culture.
Okay. That was my question.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
One of your near last comments this evening was about what are the implications of being Jesus' friends instead of servants?
Yes.
And I heard Robert Schuller saying the same thing earlier this year.
Great minds run in the same direction. Please, go ahead.
Well, he was excited about that as far as the sharing of the faith, the temple of the community. It seemed to go along with a lot of Robert Schuller's work for many years. And I'm wondering what your picture, what you see, what are the implications for worship, for life in the community, for sharing the faith?
Lovely question. First of all, we ought to say it's a very hard thing to achieve. I don't think our experience in the church is of this happening all the time. Luther said not until the return of Christ would clergy and a layperson be friends. Doesn't make that true. It's just that it's a kind of interesting expression of frustration. I started thinking about it in terms of church structure and thinking how it seems to me as we get more frustrated and more divided about things in a church like the ELCA that we have more and more canon law and more regulation and like each other less and less through all of that. Some of that is surely necessary. For there to be any institution with any purpose, there have to be some boundaries and some limits. But isn't this a kind of bottom line, or isn't this kind of something that we have to keep coming back and testing ourselves again? That Jesus is redefining in a radical way how the basis on which Christians relate to each other is one of friendship, and not one of the kind of what we really bought from the Roman Empire was a sense that you could only have things in a kind of orderly and successful way if it was organized. Now, one doesn't jump from the way we live now to the full promise of the gospel. Well, what would some ventures in friendship look like? Maybe we need sessions on the future of the church that don't involve the seminary professor coming in lecture, even if a lot of people think that's very nice, but where we sit down and talk about this with one another, where we hear more voices. On worship, maybe feminist critique is right. It's been orderly, and that's been good. That's better than the chaos at Corinth, but not enough of it comes from the congregation. How does one learn from, I think, that kind of feminist critique that there should be less focus on, you know, controlling leadership and more ability for the worship to come up from the life of the people of God? I think particularly in a very sort of anal compulsive church like the Lutheran Church, we could really probably go pretty far in terms of some experiments along these lines. Could we be less in the legislative mode with each other so much of the time and more in the mode of friends, collaborators, people working together around common things? You can tell from what I'm saying, I'm not very far into working out what it means for me, but it's one of those verses that rings in my mind. Is full of promise that we've never been able to fulfill particularly.
It sounds like you're assuming that there's assumption behind that it's the clergy that are the ones that like to legislate and sort of order and structure.
Oh, I think on many issues we do, and I think on others lay people would like to do it. I think in many ways the heavy legalistic central control structure of the church was imposed on us largely by clergy who wanted to be sure the ELCA was politically correct.
Yeah.
And I think what that then fed on certain issues like sexuality was a kind of lay and some clergy backlash to say, great, we've got a central control mechanism that more than one can play with.
Yeah, but I'm not going to suggest that clergy don't do that, but I see a lot of it among the laity, and that there's even a disquietude, you know, if it's not all structured and clearly defined. And
quite right, and I want to keep saying the notion that we could live without structure is a very naive notion. But when so much then of the structure we have comes out of our anxieties, it seems to me then this notion that a part of what we are together, a crucial part, maybe the bottom line of what we are together, is that we're friends
to avoid anxieties.
Yeah.
Please. I sat in a panel that was talking about leadership recently outside of the context of the church, business leaders. And it sounds like, I mean, we're returning to a first century model that Jesus gives us, but they were talking about how in the business world they've had to move from authoritarian leadership to almost a leadership that frees the people with whom they work to achieve what they can achieve. And it sounds like we're kind of all, it's part of a cultural shift.
And we ought to experiment with this and see what we can learn from it. I mean, it's not, nothing's going to be the cure-all.
Yeah.
We were saying over in the ice cream line, how is this like the future of the church? Well, Rocky Road is the best flavor of the present, the future. There's no way to look at this, but I think we haven't done enough playing around with this. I've been impressed that our seminary, because we're stressed financially, because we don't have enough staff and enough help, and we're trying to be responsive, and we're not very good at it, and trying to get better, that we get kind of more and more anxious models. Every once in a while, we get a group of people together and say, we're not getting anywhere on this project, well, what can we do? And it's just amazing. The ideas that are there that don't come up through that more anxious structure. I'm certainly not presenting this as a panacea, but I'm in interesting conversation with the kind of business people that I meet when I travel about how particularly Japanese corporations, but I think some American corporations too, have said, can't we get people together in a kind of think tank model and try to figure out? Often, the person who doesn't have the right place in the pyramid has the missing information that the leaders can't see. I don't want to say sitting in this room, particularly if we just all talk things out, that it would all work. 40 of us came here a summer ago from around the ELCA, 10 Higgins Road folks, 10 bishops, 10 parish pastors, 10 laity. I don't know which of those categories I fit in. Somehow I was there too. And the hope of the leaders was if we just all talked for 3 or 4 days, we'd get a common vision for the church. And it was a very genial time, and we had a wonderful time together, and the longer we talked, the less we agreed. So please don't hear this if we just talk to each other. But there might be some specific tasks where the kind of very structured stuff we have is not the way to go about it. And we're more of a friendship mode, more of a mode of meeting as equals could be interesting.
Does that come back then to our role as the Wooden Sacrament? I mean, what is the role of pastor? Because many of us have gotten sucked into other types of tasks that perhaps are not ours to carry out?
Well, I think we're coming out of a time where the pastor was the kind of YMCA executive, you know, leading lots of programs. And every stage that you move through a church history, you learn some things from that you don't cast off. There's some value to that. We certainly know that a component of good parish ministry is going to be some programming gifts and skills, but that's kind of endless work. My sister is a pastor in the Southern Ohio Synod, and one year during Advent, Ken Sauer, who is her bishop, said, let's all try as an experiment for this 4-week period to make Word and Sacrament ministry our number one priority. It's the Christmas season, maybe people will be nice to us if not everything else gets done, and let's see what happens. There were some kind of interesting, modest suggestions of, you know, some folks who were surprisingly well prepared to preach for a change, and, you know, a little attention to the liturgy, which is nice in a kind of festive season like Advent. My own guess about the Church of the Future is if there's going to be a vital Lutheran church 50 years from now, that Lutheran pastors will be more like rabbis than we've been in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean people who have real skills to teach the tradition to those who want to pass it on without a lot of exterior society support to do that. That's going to be an interesting kind of change. But I think that's what it's going to take. We ought to look at the way that the home in Judaism is a real center of teaching, that the liturgical life is not just focused on the festival occasions where people come together. Couldn't we help people with that? Do we really have in most of our communities a library that could be the base for that kind of teaching? Well, now with new information systems, it's not going to be hard to get that kind of stuff. I think for the longest time we'll try to hold on to the YMCA executive model and add more things to it. But Joe Sittler saw, 50 years ago, the kind of maceration of ministry that was going on with that. I mean, you're responsible for so many different things. How do we help each other have the kind of discipline to have a center for what we're doing? And to be able to be disciplined around that charisma. To be able to say, I'm hungry for John 4, but my goodness, on the scale of urgent things, it's only number 49. How could we push it up a few now? Please.
I was struck by, among your many comments, two in particular. One was that we proclaim the gospel not only when we preach, but when we celebrate the sacraments. The other was that the gospel is not to be seen as an engine for social change. I thought of two things immediately. The first was the 11th chapter of Corinthians, where Paul is complaining that the congregation is not discerning the body. And if I understand the exegetes I've read, he's complaining about the fact that people were maintaining their class identities in the midst of that congregation, rather than living out their new identity in Christ. The implication being that if they had heard the gospel and proclaimed the gospel in that situation, they would have been behaving in a way that overcame those separate free identity, slave identity. And I wonder, is it really true that a congregation in that Roman slave economy-based society, who in fact to any extent succeeded in overcoming that identity, would not by that very fact be generating social change? The second situation I immediately thought of was a situation I suspect you and many others in the room have been in, and that's those marvelous worship services during the 60s with the civil rights movement, and there was a preaching, and it wasn't just the preacher preaching, but the whole congregation was preaching. And then they left and they went on a march, and the feeling you got was they didn't stop one activity and do another, they just moved the worship service out into the street. Mm-hmm. And I personally have no doubt that some of those marches generated social change, and so I respond in this way, and I'd like you to respond to how
you understand. They're very rich comments. Let me try to say something about each one of them. Paul says something that sticks in my mind in this same discussion in Corinthians. He says, when we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. That's very interesting. We don't usually think. And he's obviously talking about something broader than presiding. That hasn't developed all that much in Paul's own time. There's something when a whole community does that, it's engaged in an act of proclamation. I've been trying to figure that out most of my adult life. I think he's on to something that isn't, I haven't quite factored into it. Some of it has to do with this. When we come forward and receive with open hands the Lord's Supper and ask to be touched by that, it's a largely private, personal thing for us, at least in as Lutheran piety is generally done, but it's also a public act of witness. We say something to each other when we do that. I've found myself in recent years very moved by watching that procession of people and thinking of the lives that have so little in common with each other that suddenly open themselves up to expose the same need that's there. I mean, in many cases, people who look like they wouldn't need anything. Now, we could give all kinds of other explanations. Well, it's just a tradition, or, you know, everybody wants to be nicer when you take people in rows, everybody goes. But there's something going on there. There's something going on there that's wonderful, that is a form of the gospel. I don't know what Paul thought they should have done, what would have been better in Corinth, but it had gotten so bad, by the time he wrote, he said, let's not eat in the church at all. This will be proof to you that Lutherans had not been unduly influenced by Pauline theology. A lot of eating in the church. But I can't reconstruct from that what he thought the right behavior would have been, but certainly the insensitivity to hungry and, you know, stuff full within the same gathering was somehow wrong. Now, you got to think of it as a house church. The passage won't make any sense if you think of it as a cathedral where there might well be poor over in one corner and the rich in it. This is a face, this is a community like this. It's a face-to-face community where there's so little regard for one another at the human level that no barriers are breaking down. I think Paul got fairly scared himself at the notion that the Galatians thing would really be acted upon. I think Paul was actually a fairly conservative, former rabbi and thought of these things largely in spiritual terms. But even for Paul, there was something so wrong about that. I miss the 60s enormously. That's not a very good response to what you're saying about that. I just like to testify to it, and I am sorry, though it was a flawed decade like any other, I'm sorry to see it now as the favorite whipping boy decade of American politicians, because there was a kind of hopefulness for those of us who lived through that time, a kind of non-cynicism about the problems of the society that we could sure use a little bit of right now. My guess is with those worship services you talked about, that there was a kind of form Christian faith that certainly a lot of African Americans brought to those, for example. You know, you weren't just starting from scratch. I mean, years of the powerful witness of the historic black churches had led people to the point where there wasn't a great distinction between what you do in the church and what you do out on the street. We've made now almost a complete distinction between the two. I'm trying to find a way in my own theological work, and maybe some of you are trying to do this too, to make a distinction between using the gospel as a pretext for social change. That's what seems to me won't work finally, just isn't convincing, though it's been tried many times in the last 200 years. I want to distinguish between that and something that I think is quite right, that the gospel has social implications, some of which are potentially revolutionary. But it doesn't just leave the status quo. Didn't we have that last Sunday? The road not taken, I'd have to say, in the great majority of cases. That's a very interesting story. Partly it's a story of pastoral self-restraint, where Paul is interested not only in what Philemon does, but why he does it.
Yeah.
Very interesting kind of thing. And I think most of us either want people to do the right thing, or we don't think that, you know, the gospel has any implications. It seems to me Paul is troubled by the situation, but it's almost friends, isn't it? I'm mixing John and Paul now, but it's almost like it's not going to help for Paul to demand what Philemon wants to do. He's a sort of proto-Lutheran at this point. He wants not only him to do it, he wants him to do it for the right motivation. Very interesting when so many of us get very impatient with congregations, and then either cynical that the gospel has any implications, or kind of preachy and bossy about saying, now you have to do what I tell you. I mean, very clearly turns out that they don't. Even if you say Jesus wants you to do this, people are quite immune to that, quite willing to say, what an interesting opinion you have. What a boring opinion. Please.
Could you say some things about Lutherans in mission? I mean, it seems like we know how to do social ministry.
Yes.
And that can be one way in which we witness to both faith and grace. But
yes,
we don't have very many other models about trying to proclaim grace outside of the worship space.
You mean we could bandage you up if you needed that, or we can invite you to church. But that's about it.
Yeah, and even the latter is a stretch.
It's tough, because they might come. And if we're really going to get serious about the mission thing, one of the things we've got to face is we're nowhere near having consensus in the church that this is a good idea. There might be a growing group of church leaders who say this is the time for mission, but I'm not. I mean, most of the congregations that I visit wouldn't mind if a wealthy doctor moved in to the community who would pledge a lot of money and be just like them and not, you know, put any demands on the church. But that's basically not who's there available as new members. We got people who are different and people with problems, and most of us feel so sorry for ourselves that our lives are so full and so skeptical whether there'd really be enough grace to go around if a lot of other demanding and difficult people got there. We're going to put our hand to the plow. We've got to count the cost. And there have to be, in some ways, the rhetoric is way ahead of where we are about mission. And the church's leadership is way ahead of what the actual situation seems to be. And I think it's really up to pastors now to partly get some foundations laid for that, to do some Bible preaching and teaching and praying about mission, and we have done that kind of stuff to the point of saying it won't work. I just don't really think we've engaged that issue. This is deeply related to one of the other big Lutheran failures, which is to figure out what to do with ministry in daily life, which we know is a very big resource in our tradition, but don't know how to cash in. We've all been irritated by people who can never stop talking about their faith and get out pocket testaments and all that. And here is at so many points, we take our not liking how certain evangelicals do it as an excuse not to do it at all. I'm much impressed with the congregation I visited a number of years ago in the Chicago suburbs. Now, it was a big congregation, and they could do some unusual things. They had some real support groups of people who worked in the same kind of vocations, who came together and found it enormously helpful as being able there to be out of the closet Christians, to talk to one another about how their faith and daily life connected. There was a group of healthcare workers, for example, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, hospital administrators. I mean, you know what a stressful thing it is to work in that system, and really the kind of burdens we're entrusting to those people. To bring folks together there for some support and mutual pastoral care, wonderful thing to do. So I think there need to be some way to work on renewing. If it's just the witness of the clergy, God help us. I mean, that's not going to do it. Clergy need to play a leadership role, a teaching role. We need to be comfortable talking about our own faith, but it's got to get contagious in some way before it could work.
Don't we short-circuit ministry and daily life by suggesting that daily life is lived under the law?
I wish it were lived under the law. It would be a big step up.
It doesn't go short.
Under a law of some kind. Rather than say under the gospel.
I don't find those
absolute law gospel. I guess I could get out my old textbooks and try to work that up. I don't find that those very helpful distinctions. Law and gospel is a kind of dynamic, it seems to me, where one's going back and forth all the time. I don't know which one I'm under at some points. To the extent that Paul talks about virtues as very important in a Christian community, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. We need to be figuring out how the Christian community can foster those things. And then, to the extent that some of that stuff shines through us, I think people would be curious about that. Some of you former students know how I get into talking with people on airplanes and that kind of thing. And I just have the sense people are enormously restless with their own lives. They're very busy and they're skeptical that anything could be any different. But if you talk to folks for about half an hour, they're really kind of restless, and if you ran into somebody who sort of seemed rooted and content and happy, I think it would just knock you off your feet. And I wonder if partly our life in the church isn't trying to prepare us to live that way in the world, so we could be sort of disconcerted. Isn't that we're always going to be the most loving or the most patient or the most generous, but every once in a while there ought to be a kind of implacability about us that would make people excited. Why are you that way? Why do you do that? What keeps you going? And then I think we've got to be well enough prepared in the life of our congregations to be able to give an account of the faith that's within us. It's real, and we need to be saying it's one of the responsibilities of the baptized that you got to be able to give a 5-minute testimony to what God and Jesus Christ means in your life. And let's practice it. If that's so impossible to do, let's practice. Let's get some people to do it. We're good at it. And that's contagious too. People will, could we find some ways in our gatherings gatherings. I don't know that I want it during the Eucharist necessarily, but couldn't there be some way in our church gatherings where some people would lead off by talking a little bit about what their faith means to us? Might be just the thing in a church council meeting that one person would be willing to share something about what their faith meant to them. Some of you lived in England, and you know this program I think is so great called Songs of Faith, in which the BBC works around the religious diversity of England by going around to different communities and going to one of the churches within that community, and about two-thirds of the program is they're singing the four hymns they like the best. Well, it's great. You know, you got sort of ordinary folks, and that tends to be a lot of hymns that might not be, you know, the greatest musical things ever, but people are singing it with love and fervor and devotion, and you're kind of moved by seeing them there. In between, no sermon, but interviews with people in that community talking about what their faith means to them in daily life. Maybe a bunch of three-minute vignettes. Very moving. Very nice to hear that kind of stuff. A good question to ask about our congregations would be, is there room for any of that to bubble up? Is there room for some of those voices to be heard? I would guess in most congregations I know, it's the women who do that. And the men are virtually inarticulate on this score. Not that we would have to be that way, but we just don't have it. It's maybe only in those women's groups around those women's Bible studies where the Word is studied and where some of that personal testimony. I'm sorry, I kept you waiting. I'll yield.
Don't be sorry. Sometimes I think that we, as clergy, contribute to restlessness and anger in society and in our congregation. And I liked what you said about grace, and I believe it's true that if we're going to be a viable church, that we are going to have to work with a lot more grace. But I really struggle because with that, I would love to be a more graceful person with my parishioners. But I see myself doing that to people who take no responsibility either. And I don't see Jesus really. Sometimes I see him letting go of people who didn't take responsibility, like the rich young ruler or Judas or others. And I have a struggle. I don't know what to do there. I would love to be more graceful, and yet, do you call people to responsibility?
These are wonderful comments. I won't be telling you anything you don't know, but maybe reminding you of some things that get lost under the pressure of it. It'd be a lovely thing if you were more gracious, but that's almost irrelevant. It's the grace of God flowing through us. We need to go back and renew ourselves at the wall of falling theology that we preach not ourselves. My goodness, my graciousness and good humor is a very volatile thing, easily displaced. And God help the church. My ministry of grace is based on that. I mean, that would be an even weaker reason than what we've got to work with. So don't, it'd be great if you, I don't want to say be hostile, but I want to say, don't put so much of the stress on how gracious you can be. One of the hardest things of ordained ministry is you've got to say a word of grace to people you don't particularly like or care for. But it is your message to them, after all. I mean, if we're convinced about the gospel, it's God's. I don't know who could parent something like the ELCA right now with all the anger that's there, all the frustration and all the need. Well, the answer is none of us could, but God could. And we're kind of stuck with the message that compounds us at points. And we almost wonder if God isn't being foolish about all this. But it's our tradition, at least in this community, to read the message in such a way, not that it's just grace, don't worry, be happy. And that would be that. There's enough of that around that you don't need another version of that. But it's the stories told, like Susan read that tonight, in which finally grace and love and mercy and peace and forgiveness comes through as the bottom line, as God's ultimate word for folks. We've had some stressful situations with our grown sons this last year, and just the urge to kill gets strong at certain points. And yet there's, of course, a sense in which, on the analogy with family life, they are our own dear children forever. We're not always being able to work at that thing. So we have to find some way to make a distinction between a word that flows through us and then how we work as people, not to be patsies and not to be taken advantage of in leadership. I think one of the disciplines of an experienced pastor is a certain amount of time and prayer every week. I don't know if this comes from Bonhoeffer or where I got this, but it seems right to me. a certain brief but regular time every week for people that you're having trouble working with, that you have to work with anyway. A kind of reconstruction of vision as God would see them. After all, your relationship with them is kind of small potatoes in terms of the coming kingdom of God. But how can that message flow through you? How can we be encouraging when we come together as clergy and leaders in the church to let that be the case of what happens? Can we do some venting with each other so that we don't take it out in a way that's not helpful on parishioners? Please.
Future of the church. M. Scott Peck, in his Further Along the Road Less Traveled, in his epilogue is challenging the psychological community to take seriously spirituality. Talks about four stages of faith development, coming from lawlessness to right and wrong, moving to what do you hold to be true, the doctrine, moving to skepticism, level three, and four is a mature, grown-up faith. He also says there that if you're two stages apart, you mistrust each other. In terms of the future of the church, or especially the confessional movement you call the Lutheran Church, okay, I think our theology is very paradoxical. We live in that, at least that third stage. And I think what he says is each person needs, you can't skip the stage. You can't jump to the level four. You have to go to the one, two, three, four. I see a lot of people, especially in the Pacific Northwest, who are in church, they don't even know the story of Jesus. There's a lot of fundamentalists that are really having their day. Okay. But I was at the Promise Keepers Convention, and I was talking to a guy who helped organize. He came out of a charismatic fundamentalist church. I asked him where he worshiped. He said he was going to a Greek Orthodox church. And I asked him, you know, I knew something because he studied the Vatican Center. I said, well, why are you doing that? He gave me two reasons for it. He said, one, I don't need to be evangelized every Sunday. In other words, what he was hearing is the church now. The biggest thing is for you to make a decision for Christ. He's saying, I already did. Number two is that there's got that sense, and I think he's moving in this level of faith as well, why I preface that. He's moving to a level of saying, there's got to be more. And he was intrigued by the historical and liturgical tradition of the Orthodox Church. My comment is I'm wondering whether we're getting very anxious in the Lutheran Church because we aren't very good maybe at level one and two. We're dang good at level three, and that there will be people in 10 years from now that are going to be asking, isn't there something more coming?
It might turn out to be, see, if you could, one of the gains in a post-ecumenical church is you could give up thinking you had to be all things to all people, and you could be part of a larger movement that where you don't write everybody else off, but you see those also as part of the people of God. And then you could say, all right, we don't have to be everything, but what could we be? Both in continuity of the heritage that we've received and also in terms of what we see the need to be in our time. Maybe it would turn out that a Lutheran church on down the line was a wonderful place to end up when you'd been through a kind of evangelicalism that was wonderful in terms of, I've got some skepticism about faith development, but there's something to it, let's go with that. When you'd been through that, but found that in the end, it really is a human realization, a human achievement thing, and that lo and behold, sin abounds, even among those who've made a decision for Christ. Maybe we'd be a kind of, you know, recovery place for people who've tried, and it wouldn't be that we'd be a higher stage even, that's where I get nervous about that, but just a different part of the thing, working with people who had found just an enormous need for God and for grace and for reassurance about that in their own life. One of the reasons I was trying to put together that using the full riches of what we have in our sacramental heritage with a level of freedom is I think we gotta find a way to do high, warm liturgy that keeps, I mean, now I'm being more direct about the whole thing, that keeps the mystery there That's part of what the casualty is when you turn Jesus into an engine for social transformation. See, then it's somebody's project. It's somebody's ideology. It keeps the mystery there. Now, there's all kinds of mystery in the way Susan read that story. I mean, we were just standing there in the presence of an astonishing word that keeps that there with warmth, with love, with grace, not just as a concept, but grace tied to things like friendship and a word of encouragement. How are you doing? And some of the stuff Lutherans have always been good at down through the centuries, which is kind of a certain practical energy to see if we couldn't be helpful to each other. Somebody's hurting, what could we do? We just heard that so-and-so has cancer. I mean, the gas went through even our community tonight, where we're real strangers. And I think part of what the gospel does, whatever it does about the larger structures of society, is it energizes. If we just come into the presence of a mystery that's kind of intriguing, then it's really just show business, isn't it? It's just aesthetic. But if that mystery has a kind of life-transforming quality about it, that's one of the real reassuring things about its power and its great efficacy. I think it has that in the Bible. I think when people are touched by the life of God, they don't go on just doing their own selfish thing, whatever relapses there are. I mean, their lives are changed and transformed, but it spoils the moment of the encounter if you have to say, by the way, there are quite a few conditions attached to this. And don't get overly excited, Moses, at the burning bush, because there's going to be a lot of inconvenience on down the line. I mean, get out of the way at that moment. Let the mystery be the mystery, and then here's where the friendship comes in. Let's not announce as the leaders in the church what the consequences of this are. Let's sit around having heard the story and help one another discern if the living water story is true, if that's the best we know about what the truth of the world is, what follows? Certainly not indifference to those that are thirsty. Certainly not a sense of, well, I'm tired of the poor, I want to move on to something else. There's be a way to be like Paul, to have self-restraint, not to have to announce how to vote in elections, but to have the community in some moment of its life sitting around saying, you know, let's figure out the ethical part of it together. I'm now not going to tell you as the most prominent person, the pastor who's the one university-educated person, I'm now not going to instruct you on what follows from this because I'm not sure I'd get it right. But I'll tell you what I know. And then let's see if we can't talk dialogically about what could follow from this, about what we would be able to do. It won't be the ability to solve all of the world's problems or even those. And that's partly a faith issue too, isn't it? I mean, you have to have as a Christian the kind of confidence that God has a multiplier effect. I think some of the weariness we have, moral weariness we have in our society, is the disparity between the difference I could make in my own life and the magnitude of the problems that I see before me in the media is so great that I feel disinclined to do the little bit of good that I could. Now that's a spiritual problem that needs attention. We have to say, I see why you'd feel that way and why I would feel that way, but if you feel that way, you're leaving God out of the whole thing. You're leaving God the multiplier who takes your tiny bit and my tiny bit and from that is able to do something that's truly remarkable.
Way back there, Tom. Way back.
Hello. Please.
A woman who's not even part of our congregation, but who's been kind of brushed up against our community, made a comment that I found real insightful, I think, for Lutherans. She came out of a strong church background, but fairly legalistic. And her comment was somewhat confrontive. What she said is, why have you Lutherans kept this grace a secret from the rest of the community? And in all seriousness, she said, I've never heard about grace. I never heard about grace before. This is a woman who's almost 40.
Remember this song?
Yeah.
Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. We haven't sung that one for a while. And it's funny why we've done that. I think it'd be a real interesting project to do some scholarly investigation with. My guess is it's a funny mixture of pride and low self-esteem. That we're really an odd group in the end who both kind of think too highly of ourselves to want to get out there and have to argue with people about it, but also kind of really doubt that anybody else would like this very much. I mean, some of us are better on the one than the other, but it adds up to a kind of paralysis, doesn't it? I want to say one thing, though, about the law and virtue and all that kind of thing. The fact that grace is the leading motif doesn't mean that's the only thing that we ever talk about. I mentioned the Book of Virtue, and some of us talked about this up in Bellingham a while ago. If people are saying with genuine concern, I don't know how to provide moral education for my children, this is not the moment to trot out justification by faith, folks. I mean, that's a moment to say, we ought to be able to help you. There are resources in the Christian tradition to work with that. My goodness, let's start with the Ten Commandments. Let's get out the catechism. Let's see, we can at least get some help there. Now, when someone has taught their children the commandments, and, you know, it turns out the children go ahead and, you know, kind of, what's that wonderful John Elvisacker thing, go where demons dwell, and do that whole thing, and they're really in despair and felt if they had taught some other commandments, maybe it all would have turned out right. That's a conversation about justification, isn't it? But we have sometimes, I mean, there's a kind of Lutheran gospel fundamentalism that I don't like, where because gospel's the chief message, it gets to be the answer to every question. Sometimes the question is not, where am I with God and what's the bottom line of my life, but how are we going to get through this mess? And then whether we're talking about the law or reason or common sense or whatever, we've got to draw on other resources at that point. I'm sorry, please.
That's right. We in the church aren't even, we have to decide what our kerygma is, and that sounds like what kind of what a bottom line, when you talk about whether we're embarrassed about what we have to say or we're not sure or we're too proud about it. That seems to be a fundamental issue, and I wonder if some of the clergy morale issues are tied up in that, and what is it that we really do have to offer? Some uncertainty about some of the success motif that's going around and things like that. Who are we and what are we about? And that's one of the things we really need to chew on.
I think so. I think for some of us of a certain age, we thought there was going to be more prestige in this than there's turned out to be. Few of us thought we would get rich. But for people my age and older and maybe a little younger too, we remember a time and grew up in communities where the church was awfully important. And to be a pastor was a big deal. I just wonder how true that is. I don't want to say nobody cares. I mean, that'd be a kind of self-pitying thing. But I just think, you know, the importance of it has dropped, and we talked a little bit about how we partly have done that to ourselves collectively. You know, where clergy come in the list of respect for occupations, and it's partly self-inflicted. Maybe you haven't done it, but collectively we've done it. If you add to that, then, a kind of theological uncertainty, that kind of, this is a time of transition. We've had them before in the church. For some reason, the church really goes through hell at the end of each century. And partly gets confronted with a lot of books. I mean, we've had this since John Locke wrote The Reasonableness of Christianity in 1695. We get books at centuries in that tell us we've all been real idiots and that Christianity of the future is going to be nothing like the Christianity of the past, and we've got to completely change our message. And if you're kind of tired and a little disappointed in what you're doing, and then you hear it's got to be all new, God, I mean, who wouldn't be depressed about that? I think the deeper source of it is how much we're living in a society that where the great theme, I would say, of life in the 1990s is disappointment. And that's another whole lecture that some of you probably heard in other contexts, but let me just say, I think, just invite you to write your own lecture on that. Think back to Luther's Orders of Creation and think of the disappointment so many of us have experienced in family life. And think of the disappointment in work. Not just clergy, you think these are unique issues to us. Talk about how people are feeling about work. You know, just happy to have a job and not daring to complain. Think of the disappointment we've really had in our national life, folks. When was the last time we did a great pause? I'm not talking liberal conservative now here. When was the last time we really took on a great national problem and said we have the confidence to do this and did it? I don't think there's been anything since Vietnam. Maybe some of the environmental stuff, but that now seems, you know, kind of disposable and, you know, not good for business and about to go. I think we're discouraged about that. And in odd ways, the whole current agenda, which I find so troubling in its lack of compassion, is, I suppose, a kind of attempt to do something. You know, but I don't think it's anything we're going to be real proud of in the end. I think Christianity is too deep for us to really get away with this and pretend it's really wonderful. I mean, I think some of the stridency of the current thing is people who are pushing this, even trying to talk themselves into believing that this is a virtuous thing to do. And cutting the safety net this drastically, this is foul stuff. This is the worst stuff. I mean, I may be being more political now than you want me to be, but I just have to tell you, this is the worst stuff I've seen since the Vietnam War. And that's not a total endorsement to say that everything that's been there is fine, or that it doesn't need renewal, or that there's not a lot of waste, or a lot to complain about. But the way we're going at pretending these problems don't exist is really a way to pretend that certain people don't exist. And I mean, you know, woe to us. I think we really have to say, what's the judgment of God on a society this comfortable, this relatively well off, and I'm thinking of most of our members at this point, who say, we don't have enough. We must have more. We're being asked to give too much. Many of our congregations who's going to be remembered for eternity for having been too generous. And yet that's the kind of way this whole political thing is going at this point. There aren't, unfortunately, other kinds of visions around that are particularly compelling at this point. So it's going to go on. But I think much of the clergy morale is, God, we're up against such multiple levels of disappointment. And can we, in the midst of that, present the church as this great triumph? And I think ELCA and Missouri are in the same boat there. You know, we know this is a very fragile institution. We could hardly pull off a merger in the ELCA for all the talk about a new Lutheran church. I mean, we just barely got the thing together and sort of limping along. So it isn't surprising. Who feels like they're on the winning team? And, you know, we human beings that we are, we need some social reinforcement. I think, frankly, it's one of the reasons I come to things like this. I think they're helpful. I think when we talk to each other, we're a little less lonely, a little less depressed, a little less isolated. I don't think it's that we're necessarily weaker folks than were there before. I think we're dealing with some very adverse social conditions, and we don't have a lot of experience. We went, in some ways, from a golden age in which it was relatively easy to be Lutherans in America. I mean, not that there weren't challenges, but I mean, we really had a lot going for us in the post-war period and even into the 60s and the 70s. Now we're kind of back more to business as usual. It's hard. It's hard to be a Christian. It's hard to be a pastor. You go back and read, I don't know if any of you are novel readers, but I mean, it's just a brilliant thing. If you're drowning in self-pity, and I'm pretty good at it sometimes, Conrad Richter, a great novelist of the last generation, wrote a novel called A Simple Honorable Man, which is really about his father, a Lutheran minister in coal mine towns in Pennsylvania. It's incredible what ministry had to be two, three generations ago and what was required. I mean, we ought to be ashamed and too down in the dumps about this. But that's not what we remember. We remember a time that looks like there were plenty of resources and we were starting new congregations, and gee, even in the Pacific Northwest, there was some growth for a while. Please.
I'd like to ask, I came in a little late, so if you've spoken about this already, or I'll skip it, but please, I'd like to ask for a little more explanation of your first hot spot in our society about the suffering of this century. Can you say something? I don't understand that when you talk about suffering in relationship to the suffering of the past. What do you mean? What's peculiar about the suffering?
Let me try to do this very briefly, and then you and I can talk some more tomorrow if this doesn't go. If we think back 100 years to the end of the 19th century, if we look at the kind of theology that was being written, the kind of posture of the church, people were incredibly upbeat and optimistic. Even willing to say the kingdom of God is coming in history, always a foolish thing to say, but there was some plausibility to it. It had been in Europe and in North America a relatively peaceful century. Think how people's lives were transformed in the 19th century, the increasing level of comfort. And on up in the early part of the 20th century, there was a great deal of that momentum. There were all sorts of questions. There are always questions about what it means to believe in Jesus, and how can there be a gracious God when there's illness in my life? My grandmother died in 1906, a very young woman of tuberculosis. I left my grandfather with three young children who had come as an immigrant to a young man to America. That must have been awful. I'm not saying they didn't feel the suffering of God, but then look what happened on down through the century. great war after war with incredible devastation. Awareness of how much our picture of the past had been a selective picture that had not talked about slavery, had not talked about what happened to the native inhabitants of America, had not talked about the role of our own forebears all that kind of thing. Awareness through television now of the great hunger and the great violence that fills the world. You could, up to a certain point, maybe up to World War II, you could close your eyes during the movie newsreels and not be overly aware of this. We're bombarded with it on a kind of daily basis. And it raises for us, maybe not for all of us, but it raises for certain folks, how can you just go on talking about a good and loving and gracious God when this has been one of the most terrible centuries the world has ever lived through? We talk about the Holocaust, and we need to, because that's such a fundamental revelation of what human beings are capable of, but we all know it's the tip of the iceberg. We know it's one of many times when people have been really quite willing to cancel out the humanity of another whole group of people and just slaughter them. I think we're sitting around in reasonably comfortable circumstances, maybe not rich or powerful, but reasonably comfortable circumstances, and we're going on about the goodness of God and how right things are in the world and all that. A sensitive person will have to think, where in the world are they? I mean, who are these Christians to be so out of it that they would think that everything would be okay? And so it's raised for many of the theological authors, particularly of the last 30 years, very deeply the question of how does it even make sense to talk about God in that kind of world, a world that could so easily be allowed to be destroyed by nuclear destruction. And I mean, we had a brief pause, didn't we, of not worrying about that, and now suddenly we see maybe that issue hasn't gone away yet either.
Isn't this just the time to be Lutherans, though?
Well, I'm not, but it sounds good to me, but tell me what you mean.
Well, isn't this just the time to talk about the God who turns his back on his people, the people of God who don't expect that he's always going to be smiling on us. I mean, that's a part of our heritage too. That's a strong piece of Luther, and it seems to me that we would, instead of talking about a good and gracious God all the time, that we might be talking about the realities. Read the Psalms a little bit.
If we looked nearer the Word, we would find a more accurate mirror of our own world than we tend to find in a lot of our preaching and teaching. I certainly grant you that. I think I might put the emphasis in a slightly different place. I think it's time for some more grown-up versions of Christianity. Okay. I think a lot of what's been around us has been a kind of naive, I mean, I don't know if we're talking about stages of development here, but has been a kind of naive projection of the protected circumstances of our own lives.
Cockeyed optimism.
The universe.
Sure.
Excuse me?
Cockeyed optimism.
Yeah. And now that falls apart, and well, cynicism, you know, despair, skepticism is one possibility, but so is mature faith. Mm-hmm. So is a faith that sees not the goodness of God as a sort of metaphysical principle that's all there is, but as the nevertheless. Mm-hmm. You know, that sees the crucified one as the one who stands at the heart of him. Yeah, oh, it'd be great, I've got a bumper sticker. I don't like bumper stickers on cars because I think they lead to accidents, but I've got one in my office drawer that says, proud to be a Lutheran. Yeah, why not? Let's do it. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Let's see what we could do with that heritage. I my favorite part of Luther these days is the theology of the cross, which mm-hmm. I take to be essentially the hidden and surprising ways that God works. Mm-hmm. And when people have been disappointed, as so many of our own people have, that's either an occasion to go away or to think more. I mean, I think we're really in fundamental agreement on this. Or an occasion to think more deeply about who God is. Is God, can you really read the external circumstances of your life and say, if I'm up, God is blessing me, and if I'm down, God is cursing me? That's the natural religion of America, folks. That's kind of the backdrop against which we have to play. But there's opportunity there. There's opportunity to say there's another way to read these stories. And it's not the story of a God who's that predictable, blessing the powerful and cursing the weak.
But another bumper sticker.
Yes.
Packwood's gone. Prayer works.
It wouldn't be for me from California to comment on that.
this at all.
Please. Well, just to follow up, I appreciate your comment about the immaturity, because my observation of the whole situation is that about this suffering is that what is different is the way this century has dealt with suffering. Seems like, and particularly the last half of this century, been a tremendous amount of denial and looking the other way and ignoring it, and if it's not in my backyard, it doesn't exist. And then when it really comes home, it's to feel terribly sorry for myself because I'm suffering and I shouldn't be. Nobody should suffer the way I'm suffering. It's wrong. Where's the quick fix?
I don't ever want to speak about suffering as if it's good for you. That's a demonic thing. And I'm not saying you're doing it. I want to be very careful with that. The biblical testimony is that even in suffering, God finds occasion to be gracious and loving and to strengthen God's people. And the great biblical sayings about this are first-person confessional sayings. They're Paul saying, when I am weak, then I am strong. That's not something somebody could say to Paul. Something he had to come to say for himself. It's Joseph saying to his brothers, yeah, you meant it to me for evil, but God made it for good. We can't stand in the pulpit and say, a little suffering would do you good, folks, although we'd like to sometimes. Really not. That's not going to be the better path. But when the bottom falls out, and I think it's going to fall out spectacularly from some of this current project of how we're going to solve all the problems of America, let's be around to pick up the pieces, not with a political solution. I mean, that somebody will need to do that too, but with some spiritual reflection on what were you hoping for? What were you thinking could happen there? Denial is it indeed. The mayor of New York City, who's a Republican, said if you make these changes for illegal immigrants and you don't let the kids go to school, well, we know what 14-year-olds are like. We're going to have an epidemic of crime that you will not believe. You want that? Well, we'll lock our doors. And it's real. I mean, it's a frightening recipe for, I mean, just having put moral pressure on South Africa for decades not to be a gated apartheid society, that's kind of where we'll be moving. And I see it all over California at this point. I mean, what we're going to do is not just live segregated. We'll put a fence around it. And we'll not even have to know that it's going on. And then we sing and we want and we thirst for what we did before the session tonight, one bread, one body. I think everybody is longing for that, but we don't see a way clear to it. Please.
I'm going to preface my question and comment here.
Are you wearing a Youth Gathering t-shirt?
No, I'm wearing a color sport.
That's fine. I just had to clarify that. Thank you.
I happen to be in a congregation that has a lot of growth right now amongst the unchurched people. And so I make a point of asking them why they're there, why they keep coming. And they say two things. One is because, to characterize it would be to say, because I don't have to leave my brain at home when I come to church. And the other thing that they say is that the people here seem to really care about what they're doing. And the question that I have is this: we're talking so much amongst us now about being seeker friendly, and I have a feeling that things are not beautiful, or something is not love because it's beautiful. That's idolatry. But if you love it, it becomes beautiful. And I wonder if we're trying to do that, making something beautiful in order for people to love it.
Well, there's something pretty horrible at the heart of our whole. I mean, it'll be dishonest packaging. I mean, if the cross isn't somehow there, the love that flows through a tough message. And I mean, if we think what seekers want is don't worry, be happy, and that's what we're packaging, this isn't going to last long. That's the seed that grows in the most shallow soil. That's not going to last a minute when the sun comes out. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, I think the comments you report from people are very encouraging, aren't they? You know, they don't have to leave their brains behind. Don't you think in the past we might have sometimes underestimated, those of us who are leaders in the church, might have underestimated our members and what they're capable of? I don't think they're looking for academic lectures necessarily. These are bright, thoughtful people. I think of my recently dead aunts and uncles who were retired factory workers and truck drivers and farmers and things like that. Not highly educated people, but they couldn't stand it when their church was taken over by, you know, for a brief period by somebody who was trying to be Jay Leno or Johnny Carson, and it was all jokes and that kind of thing. And they really counted on the fact, they knew they were getting old, and they counted on the fact that there'd be a serious, important message at the church was something that they could live for and die for. And they would rather have been challenged and not quite gotten it than had the sense that they were being patronized by something that would be just sort of warm, fuzzy kind of stuff. Very interesting. Very interesting how passionately they felt about that. I think we ought to have, but here's partly where we come to the flexibility for mission. It's probably not a bad thing at all for the ELCA that we have some congregations that are trying some very daring experiments with how they're presenting Lutheranism. That's a good sign for a church in mission. And I even want to go the extra mile, not immediately to put those places down, because that's such a standard Lutheran thing to do. And if anybody would wear exactly the same shirt, we've all got to get all upset right to the Lutheran about it. I think let's be generous and hope those are signs of vitality and spirit stirring. Where it gets demonic is the minute somebody has success, we've got to get everybody doing the same thing. That doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense at all. Now, I think there are some things we all ought to be doing. I think the evidence on our not being particularly friendly to people who come in is pretty considerable. And there'd be some ways we could test that. And I actually think people can improve. See, I don't bring justification and the hopelessness of the human thing. And that's a virtue question, and we could do that. You can get to be friendlier, even if you're not automatically so. I visited a church in another city, another part of the country, where I ran into someone that I know through academics who said to me, oh dear, what are you doing here? I think he was disconcerted and surprised to see me, but that's a kind of metaphor for a lot of what it is. So in other words, we all ought to be working on friendliness. We all ought to be working on hospitality. The notion we all ought to be doing the same kind of non-sacramental, you know, kind of rock guitar liturgy or something like that, nonsense. Let some people try that and see if people still like it after 5 years. Some of this stuff you get weary of after a while. But let's have a couple decades of experiments, and let's talk about what works, and let's try some things. But I think when you're in as new in the mission situation as we are, put all of our eggs in one basket is an enormous mistake. I know some churches that are doing very well doing the trade. Maybe it's your Greek Orthodox point. Doing the traditional Lutheran liturgy with real warmth and with real clarity, not keeping people 2.5 hours. That part of the Greek Orthodox thing is high. I wouldn't recommend that for church growth, but there's not going to be one way. And I think in some of our communities where we've got an awful lot of Lutheran churches, maybe we could even have some friendly agreement of who's going to do what, so there'd be a kind of differentiation of what's available. No church can meet everybody's spiritual needs. People who haven't had a first chance yet, I'm going to do that. John?
I get a lot of grumpy mail that comes across my desk about, and most of the time I don't know what the arguments are about, but there's one particular argument that I wonder if you might comment on. It has to do with the naming of God, particularly the Trinity. What's at stake in that argument? And, could you say something about that?
Yeah, it's a very loaded issue, and it's a linked issue. You know, where you're both talking about the issue and you're talking about something else, and you know part of what it is, but not the whole thing.
Well, I don't want to set you
It has
up
to do with power and disappointment in the church. It has to do with how deeply uneasy most of us are with women in leadership in the church. Mm-hmm. And I put myself there, too. I'm working on it. Women in my own family who are leaders in the church, which helps. But I just think that's, the hostility to the 25th anniversary of the ordination of women, I found shameful. I mean, if anything has been a mercy of God to the ELCA in recent years, it's been the way that we have been blessed and benefited by the ministry of women. And to see the number of people who ought to know better in the church say, well, there are such excesses, you know, we have to have other celebrations and all this kind of thing. We're in a rocky time, folks. It's not all going to be neat and tidy. You know, and people are going to do provocative things and say things that you don't like. And if you're in that kind of God position where you've got to be in charge of it and feel good about everything, it's just going to drive you crazy and it's going to be worse in the next century. If you're kind of focused on what your own ministry is, then there's some capacity to put a generous construction on what other people are doing. Now, the Trinity issue is very difficult, and the naming of God issue is very difficult, because there's a lot packed into Father, Son, and Holy Spirit that makes it not easy to give that up. And I'm personally not the least persuaded that Creator, Sustainer, Redeemer is a full substitute for Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What everybody ought to be able to be doing at this point is to enrich the ways that we name God, all of which use human language to do the impossible. The notion that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is kind of divine privileged revelation, let's think about that a little bit. I'd be more inclined to say this has got a privileged position in the history of the church, that Lutherans are the kind of people ordinarily that don't just throw it out because they're puzzled by it. Wasn't Luther's kind of reformation to say, if it's not in the Bible, I won't have anything to do with it? Luther's test is, if it doesn't work against the gospel, it's okay. Father, mother, is that going to work? I don't know. I bet you don't know either. Because in the end, it depends what the part of this depends on not what the leaders propose or what the theologians say or what these publications put before you, but what the people of God are willing to say amen to. And I don't think that's clear. So I'd like to have, I mean, when people trash Trinitarian theology, and I suppose some have done that, certainly I was seeing some of that a decade ago, I'm very much on the stand of saying, I sure hope you realize the stakes are high in what you're doing. I mean, have you really read Athanasius on the incarnation of the Word and Augustine on the Trinity? I mean, have you done your homework on this? You know, or is this something that you've read in a Barnes & Noble and now, you know, it's kind of being imposed on the church? On the other hand, so many of my grumpy theologian colleagues, my God, we're at the wall every minute. Every time we turn around, here's something where if we don't destroy this, it's Baal and Jezebel and good heavens, I doubt it. I really doubt it's the worst of times. I think it's a time when people are coping and trying to feel their way and there's a certain amount of chaos. Gamaliel's advice is not bad on a lot of these things. Let's wait and see. It's far deadlier. I mean, you heard my presentations. It's far deadlier not to know what the kerygma is than to have some messiness around the sides, even of an important doctrine that's been very life-sustaining. And I think it's the most Lutheran thing in the world, frankly, to be challenging some of. I think that comes out of something deep in our own heritage to say, well, I think maybe some reform is needed in this area. And the posture ought to be neither to, you know, then kind of go on the attack and play Rome to the people who are raising those things, nor to say, oh, you're right, my God, if somebody doesn't like it, we'll get rid of it. Someone's objected the baptismal formula, so we now won't use what the church has used for many centuries. Well, you go ahead. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. Are we talking about the same issue, by the way? Good. Okay.
Well, I mean, part of it for me is that you must have to be involved. The franticness, the things come at me with it is like, gosh, you know, my very faith is at stake here, and I didn't know it. You know, that's the part of it, the willingness to change.
I'll tell you something odd about it. I don't think you'll find it persuasive, but I'm coming more and more to think it. It's actually largely related to a very poisonous intergenerational situation that we have in America. Much of this comes from a generation of distinguished Lutheran theologians who have probably served the church as well as any generation that we've had for 100 years or more. You'd have to go back to the Krauss and the Walters and the Schmuckers and the Loys and the Pritchell brothers in Iowa and people like that in the 19th century defined the generation as distinguished as the most senior generation of Lutheran theologians right now. My goodness, the total distrust of the younger generation can only be paralleled by the country's hatred for Bill Clinton for having opposed the war in Vietnam, which I would have thought after the Bob McNamara book, whether you like Clinton's politics or not, would have been at least a plausible thing that somebody might have done in the 60s. It's an odd way to talk about it. I mean, it's obviously theological, but it's partly that larger society setting the agenda. And so much of the thing there is saying, oh my God, this younger generation is just so awful. I mean, they're not going to, we're going to be dead, and they're not going to value anything that that we've done. And may it be better for, I'm getting up there myself, may it be better for us. I mean, finally, part of the human task, and the task for human leaders of the church is to let go. Let somebody else have a try at it. There'll be some mistakes made. We're probably not the people that they were, although it's a rather un-Lutheran thing to go on about that. It doesn't sound like kind of you talk about a lot if you're deep into justification of faith. If you get older, I think you'd be more amazed about how, what God had been able to do through an old sinner like you. Not a lot of that mail crosses my desk. Please.
In the context, then, of what you're saying here and what you said in your lectures.
Yes.
Let's talk about Chicago offices, ELC.
Why not? It's getting more. It's after 11. Let's get it.
And the election of the new bishop. I heard you say something very positive about Dr. Anderson in terms of your perception of him. I was not there. I've talked to a couple of people who were on the floor. Their description of the whole process this year was that the ELCA made a, quote, safe decision, unquote. And that once the decision was made, they talked about what was happening on the floor after the vote was announced and so forth, and raising some questions about the excitement there. Okay, that in the context then of what you're talking about, and I guess my perception that Chicago is an increasing non-entity in the context of my local parish ministry. It seems to be disappearing more and more from the scene of trying to approach me and talk to me.
He's inviting me to say wild things. It's probably what he'd like to do. And I'm going to. It's after 11 o'clock.
That's what I feel. Chicago's disappearing from me. And I don't feel good about that.
This is the friends of Jesus late at night talking to me. Not, you know, laying down ex cathedra, but kind of talking at ease to each other, and it might be right, it might be wrong. If we do it in that context, I'll take up what you're talking about. I am happy to put in a plug for H. George Anderson. It may be safe, but it is certainly not fair to this may be the best qualified person to lead the ELCA side of American Lutheranism in the 20th century. And these are superb qualifications, and it has to be said about him. I've known him fairly well. I've not had much interaction with him in recent years. I knew him very well when he was president of Southern Seminary. Almost everything this man has touched, he has done superbly well with. God has just blessed him very, very much. And I think he won not because it was a say that probably was the safest thing to go with. I think he won because he is just an extraordinarily great gift to the church at this point. I don't think it'll be just more of the same. If you've known him, you've heard him do a Bible study, if you've been connected with any project that he's worked on, he's very well qualified to do this. Now, having said that, one has to say, let's not get carried away about what anybody could do as bishop for us. I mean, these are big problems we're dealing with. Let's not set up. I think he's going to probably do somewhere between a very good and an outstanding job. But if you think he can solve all this stuff, that's a recipe. He might as well quit right now. That's a recipe for disappointment. I mean, these battles we're talking about here are going to be won in what we can do in local communities and how we can help each other. And synods can help some, and Chicago can help a tiny amount. It's not saying it doesn't matter who's our public spokesperson. It matters a lot. And if that person does, as I think he will, speak the deep Lutheran themes in ordinary language that you don't need a theological degree to understand, that'll be a great gift to the church. And if that person is, as he is in all my dealings with him, someone that grace and good humor and warmth flows through, wouldn't that be pleasant right now? Wouldn't that be nice for a little time of trying to cheer up and feel better about each other? So it was no surprise. It seems to me that he was elected and people ought to feel good about it. Let's not set him or anybody else up to have to be a miracle worker. I think I wrote an editorial for Dialogue about this. You can actually read it in print in a couple of weeks. I think one of the hardest challenges is what he will do about the national expression of the church. Almost everyone I talked to, and I was kind of going around, I wasn't really a journalist, but I was going around like I was and trying to see why people were thinking what they were thinking. Almost everybody I talked to said, hope he can do something about Chicago. Almost everybody I talked to said that without prompting, but when you ask them what they wanted done, there was no coherent pattern that I could see in the answers. You know, names that people would like to have fired were at the top of the list of other people's list of who must be kept at all costs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're just all over the map on this, and I think he knows this. He's been part of this panel of inquiry that has had done hearings around the country. I think it shocked the socks off him to hear the kind, not only the kind of ignorance about the ELCA there was, but the kind of hostility, the kind of anger there was toward it at some points, often based on total misinformation. He'll do what he can about that. Please realize the bishop of the church is elected with no political mandate to help him in the church council or in the boards of these divisions that have enormous vested power. He's got a lot of moral authority. But he doesn't have, don't make a political analogy with it where, you know, a president can come in and cash in some chips. Chilstrom saw very early on that the church council felt completely free to pay absolutely no attention to what he was suggesting if it didn't suit. I'm not trying to set that up as a demonic group. I'm just saying, you know, there's a great role to play as a public leader on some things like ecumenism. He's going to have enormous power if he wants to use it, because people will look to the bishop of the church for help on that. On questions like structure of the church, you've got enormous vested interests of people who do not want to see change and would see change as a total surrender to this conservative reactionary country. I think since we're going to have a smaller national structure in 10 years, that seems almost inevitable to me. Why don't we be intentional about it and figure out what really matters and get a little bit ahead of the curve, and in the doing of that, treat the people who work there better than just giving them pink slips when the money runs out. I think we could have a much smaller national structure and still be something more than a collection of synods. It's evident to everyone that we need global mission folks with expertise to work there, that we can't do that kind of task in every center. There are a lot of other questions where it's not clear that we need large national structures, and where we would probably be able to do a better job harvesting in benevolence money if it were clear that it went basically to fund ministries. Right. The building is frankly one of the biggest problems. That just isn't the kind of thing anybody's enthusiastic about these days. In any realm of life, nobody likes centralized bureaucratic structures. And I will have to say, though I'm very fond of and would defend the integrity of people who work in the national expression of the church, 6 of the 7 times I've worked with national projects, I wish I hadn't. I wish I'd stayed home in Berkeley, where at least I have some influence on how things go. So there's a problem, but it's a very tough one to solve. And if he can, in the first 2 years or so, be a good, positive, warm, enthusiastic spokesperson and help us figure out what in the world to do with these very volatile ecumenical issues. If he could do that in the first 2 years, I'd give him an A+. I think that would be fine. And maybe on the far side of that, then, there's the energy to do some more, to let us really make some of the structural changes that probably are. But I hope I touched at least a couple of the bases.
My only additional comment would be that I think we need to... Our national expression needs to address many of the questions that you are. Yeah, I don't. Up to this point in time, I don't see them doing that.
I think to talk about some of the things we've talked about tonight in the ELCA, things will have to get some worse. I think there's almost, I mean, now again, to be provocative, and John tells me it's my last comment, I think an awful lot of the leadership still is restorationist. in the sense of believing if we just had the right things, including maybe a real attractive figure like H. George at the helm, it'll all come back. And if they're right, I'm happy, you know, to drink their health at the party and try to fit into that. I don't think they are. I think it has to get considerably worse before people are willing to think in new ways. You're actually close, if you're in parish ministry, you're closer to the heart of this problem than if you're working in the national. It's an odd thing to say, but you see the truth of what I'm arguing. You know how hard the mission task is, and you can't go on cranking out the standard stuff. You realize something different is needed. I think John says quite rightly, we ought to break it as a formal thing so nobody feels they're being rude to leave. I'll be around a little bit more. I don't want to cut you off, for example, but thanks very much for coming in.